So we've looked at the shift from theism to atheism, the things that have engineered it, and what it's meant in terms of dismantling the foundations of the Judeo-Christian ethic. So let's just think about some of the consequences of that. And what I'd argue is that most of these issues, abortion, embryo research, euthanasia and assisted suicide, same-sex marriage, transgenderism, the whole sexual hookup culture, the idea that sex is just recreation, drug and alcohol abuse, materialism, that these are all expressions of these three characteristics of idolatry, the shedding of innocent blood, and sexual immorality that we see in Canaanite or Amorite culture, Romans 1 stuff. It wasn't just Christians who had a high view of humanity, and Hippocrates was a Greek doctor who was a polytheist, not a theist, back in 600 BC, and he wrote what's called the Hippocratic Oath, and which all doctors used to have to sign before they were allowed to practice medicine, and it's not required anymore in most places in the world. And I've just quoted one sentence of the Hippocratic Oath here, but what's amazing is if you read the Hippocratic Oath, you'll say, okay, I don't agree with the first paragraph about where all the various Greek gods are mentioned, but pretty much everything else in it about confidentiality, care for patients, not exploiting people, protecting life, this having respect for one's colleagues, being committed to teaching the new generation, most of it is quite consistent with a Christian worldview. And I've just picked this one sentence out. I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest such counsel, nor in like manner will I give a woman a pessary to produce abortion. So Hippocrates was opposed to abortion, euthanasia, and infanticide, but he was not coming from a Christian perspective at all. But there's a lot of overlap between the Hippocratic ethic, which drove medicine for many centuries, and the Judeo-Christian ethic. But what we've seen over the last 50 or 60 years particularly is that medical ethics have been rewritten. Now, after the Second World War, largely because of what happened in Nazi Germany, the World Medical Association of doctors got together and they drafted some new ethical codes, which were really restatements of the Hippocratic Oath. And again, I'm just taking one sentence out of them, but it's very interesting to look at documents like the Declaration of Geneva, the International Code of Medical Ethics, and so on, which all came out in the late 1940s after the Nazi Holocaust, and comparing them with a Christian worldview, and to look at the way particularly that they've been changed. So when the Declaration of Geneva was first written, and remember, these are not Christians, these are just doctors worldwide, it says, I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception. Even under threat, I will not use my medical knowledge contrary to the laws of humanity. Now, the Declaration of Geneva was amended in the 1980s, and the word conception was changed to beginning. The thinking behind that, of course, was that abortion was becoming increasingly practiced in Europe and in particular. And so by using the word beginning, you're using the beginning of life in a way that's conveniently undefined or defined very vaguely, because at least open the question, well, when does life begin? Is it fertilization, or when the organ system's there, or the first movements, or at birth, or the first breath, or whatever? So it left that as an open question. And in many ways, it was abortion that led the move, because if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, then almost all countries in the world regarded abortion as unethical. And it was the former Soviet Union initially who started practicing it. Then Britain was the first European country, really, that did outside Scandinavia in 1967, legalized abortion. The US in 1973, and then 80% of the world's population now lives in countries where abortion is legal. But if you look at all the deaths in the world, it's as easy to remember, because 100 million people die every year. 100 million people die every year in the world. 57 million of them are from all causes other than abortion, but 42 million of those deaths are from abortion, where a doctor or a nurse or other health professional is killing a baby in the womb. So actually, the biggest killer of human beings in the world is abortion, accounting for, you know, approaching half of all human death in the world. And that was not the case 100 years ago. It's been a shift that we've lived through. So 40 million abortions, 43 million abortions a year, 57 million deaths a year from all other causes, including heart disease and cancer and strokes and infectious diseases and so on. You think of COVID, 6 million deaths in 2 years, World War II, 55 million deaths. It's just to give you a comparison of the amount of human death from abortion compared to everything else that's happened. And if we look at the countries in the world, the countries in red have abortion on demand, the darker brown colour, so that China there. And you see the countries which have restricted abortion laws tend to be those in the global south, particularly sub-Saharan Africa and the Muslim world. And abortion became so common under the communist empire that about 10 to 15 years ago, Russia tightened its abortion laws because they were worried that there weren't enough young people coming through and too many dependent elderly. And there was more than one abortion for every live birth at that stage in communist Russia. So not because of any Christian revival or redevelopment of conscience, but simply for pragmatic reasons of the demographic effects abortion was having on the population. In the Far East, it's a different kind of problem because it tends to be selective abortion of girl babies. 160 million missing women in China and India. And if you look at the sex ratio at birth in different countries, normally there are about 104, 105 males for every female born. That's just the natural way it is that boy babies tend to survive more. So if there's no intervention, that's the number you expect, is 105 to 100. But in the countries of these three tall ones in a histogram is Vietnam, China, and India, so South and East Asia, it's 112. And why is that? Well, because of selective abortion of girl babies, discover them on ultrasound and abort them for different reasons. It's all related to the caste system in India. And in China, it was more related to the one-parent family. You can only have one baby, so people want a boy rather than a girl for various reasons. And so you can imagine how we could spend a lot of time talking about the consequences of this mismatch, particularly in China, but the way it affects the society. But there are many more boys than girls, so there are going to be a lot of men who are unmarried and can't find women, and so that in itself provides an impetus for things like human trafficking. Artificial reproduction, so the technologies that are developed, there are about 8 million babies born by IVF each year. We now have technology, we've had to donate sperm for much time, but we can donate eggs, harvest them, cause conception to take place in a laboratory. And then there's surrogacy as well, where you can commission someone to bring up your biological child. So I'm just highlighting these things that are new. What's behind the huge drive to artificial reproduction? Well, part of it is that we've got technology that we can do things that we couldn't do before. But a lot of it has been fueled by, first of all, delayed reproduction. So in the Western world, women tend to delay childbirth and child rearing until they're older, into their 30s and early 40s. When they're less fertile, it's more likely that they're not going to be successful, and so there's a bigger need for technology to help them. Also, the rise of sexually transmitted infections has been a cause of infertility, blocked tubes, so women can't conceive, or they can conceive, but they can't get the egg through to the uterus where it can be fertilized. And also the fall in babies available for adoption. And that's had two big drivers. First of all, a lot more solo parents keeping their children rather than giving them up for adoption. But the really big driver is abortion. because babies that would previously have been adopted out are being killed in the womb, so they're no longer available. So it's very, very, very difficult in most Western European countries now to adopt a baby that is, you know, biologically normal and doesn't have special needs. Prenatal selection. So we can, I've talked about doing ultrasounds to detect female babies in China and India and so on, go to a private clinic, find out what it is, choose an abortion if it's the wrong sex. But we have a lot more technology now to identify genetic diseases in the womb as well. And you can do that at three stages. You can either do it with the human embryo at just a few cells stage, produce an embryo by fertilization in a laboratory, take off a couple of cells, do a karyotype test or genetic test on those cells. The remaining ones will still grow into a normal individual, but if you discover a genetic abnormality, then you just don't implant those embryos. Or chorion villus biopsy is taking a little sample from through the neck of the womb at about 8 to 10 weeks. You can do the same thing. Or amniocentesis is where you put a needle into the womb at about 18 to 20 weeks, halfway through pregnancy, draw off some fluid, and you can examine that. So the point is that we've got the technology now to do very sophisticated search and destroy operations for babies with special needs. And the biggest casualty of all has been children with Down's syndrome, trisomy 21, where it's very easy to detect. And so the number of children with Down syndrome in most European countries has fallen dramatically because of this technology. Contraception, of course, is something new as well, came with the sexual revolution, and that raises ethical questions about what forms of contraception are right or wrong. Many Catholics would think all contraception is wrong. Most people from Reformed or Protestant backgrounds would say, well, it depends on your intention and the means that you're reason you're doing it. But there are some contraceptives which are, or techniques which are what we call post-coital. In other words, they act after fertilization. So rather than stopping egg and sperm coming together, what they do is prevent an embryo that's already formed from implanting in the womb. So technically they are very, very early abortions because they're destroying a human being. Let's come back to that. Euthanasia, push for making it legal. At least 10 US states now, Switzerland, Austria, allowing assisted suicide, where a doctor helps someone to end their own life. And then euthanasia and assisted suicide is legal in those countries, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Spain, euthanasia only in Belgium. So assisted suicide is where the doctor helps the patient to kill themselves. Euthanasia is where the doctor ends the life of the patient. So that's the difference between them is just the agent at the end. But we're seeing now, and we'll come back to this when we look at euthanasia, the way it's progressing to new categories of people, especially in countries like the Netherlands and particularly in Canada. So those are they tend to be politically left states which have legalized assisted suicide. And then if you think about same-sex marriage, this is all very recent. It was just in the late 1990s that the first countries legalized it, but now in most Western countries, same-sex marriage is legal. So just a few headlines, Spain, Austria. And then these extreme reports, female Dutch doctor drugged a patient's coffee and asked her family to hold her down as she fought not to be killed, but they did not break the country's euthanasia laws. So the concern about cases of people who are either disabled or have dementia or have mental health problems being exploited and abused through euthanasia. Belgium authorized euthanasia with terminally ill 9 and 11-year-olds in the youngest cases worldwide. And we talked about Russia with the different, the growing concern about abortion and its demographic effects on the age structure of the population. And this is just to illustrate this. These are demographic pyramids. In other words, they show you the number of people in a population at each age group. And if you look at most African countries or countries in the developing world, they have age pyramids like this. So lots and lots of young people, very few older people. And most European countries looked like this not too long ago, certainly in the 19th century, early 20th century. And so what we've got here is Japan, but you could, Japan's perhaps an extreme example, but you could apply it to pretty much any Western country in terms of the change of demography as a result of people having smaller families, the rise of abortion, and also coupled with that, better care for elderly people, better medical treatments available. So all these things have meant that Japan in 1950, which looked like this, with 35% of people aged 15 and under, and only 5% 65 and older, by the time we get to 2007, it's 13 and 21. But notice also that the number in the working ages between 15 and 65 has gone up in percentage. But this is the projection at the end for 2050 if current trends continue. And you've got 35% under 15 becomes 8%. And 5% over 65 becomes 39%. This is why in Japan, one of the huge drivers of robotic technology is this, that you know there aren't enough people in the working age group, enough young people to look after the growing number of elderly people, so we need robots to do it. But you can see why some commentators say that the society that began by killing its children through abortion will in turn, that generation will be killed by its children through euthanasia. And so the demographic trend is, if you add into that financial difficulties, unemployment, toxic debt, and this non-Christian worldview, you can see why in coming ages euthanasia is becoming more popular because of the huge burden that elderly and disabled people create for our society. So if we can somehow convince ourselves that it's not wrong and perhaps even a moral good to be able to hasten people off to death early, then you could see how the demography plays into that. And then, of course, the whole transgender revolution. I worked for Christian Medical Fellowship for 27 years from 1992 until 2018. And up until 2015, I was never once asked to give a talk on transgender. Not once. But in the last 2 years, from 2016 to 2018, or 3 year period, 16, 17, 18, about half of all the talks I was asked to give were on transgender. That's how quickly everything changed. And we had as what time describes here as a tipping point when suddenly something that was never an issue suddenly became a huge issue. And we had celebrities giving it value. So Bruce Jenner, this is the famous Vanity Fair magazine cover, Call Me Caitlin. Bruce Jenner was an American decathlon athlete who won a gold medal in the 1976 Montreal Olympics. And then later in about 2014-15, I can't remember the exact date, he appeared on the front page of Vanity Fair magazine because he says, I'm now a woman, call me Caitlin. And Bruce Jenner is also part of the Kardashian family as well, which you will have heard of, so you get very high media profile. So it was that in films like The Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne starring as someone who'd undergone a transgender change and had surgery for it at the beginning of the 20th century. And suddenly we had this new phenomenon, which seemed to come from nowhere, and these are headlines from Britain. Gender identity clinic services soar under strain as referral rates soar. So all of a sudden we're having all these children, teenagers and so on saying, I'm transgender and I want help, I want hormones, I want puberty blockers, I want surgery to change. And these are the referrals to the Tavistock Clinic, which was doing this just over the period from 2009 to 2016. And you can see the exponential rise, particularly of girls being referred for transgender transitions. And what's really interesting is that if you go back 20 or 30 years and look at what we used to call gender identity disorder, what's now called gender dysphoria, it was far, far more common in boys than it was in girls. But now with the rise, for a whole variety of reasons, it's girls who make up the majority of people who are wanting to switch. And these are the referrals to that clinic in London by age. So you've got the number of young people up on this axis, up to 450. And then along here, the ages from 3 up till 17. And you can see that the vast majority of those people seeking help were 14, 15, and 16, so the mid-teenagers. But some of them were as young as 3, 4, and 5, being brought often with the support of their parents for, puberty blockers and then later hormones and then later surgery. We've looked at the change of worldviews in Europe and the reasons for those. We've looked at the fruit of that change in terms of the shedding of innocent blood, sexual immorality, transgender, and all this stuff. And then we've looked at the biblical principles about having the mind of Christ, holding the commands of Christ, displaying the character of Christ, and carrying the cross of Christ. And even though we haven't delved into the ethics of all these issues in great detail, that I hope that's at least helpful in terms of giving you the tools to think about it. Because, as we've said, you can't go and look up these issues in the Bible from Bible Gateway or Concordance. But nonetheless, we're told that Scripture is profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, training in righteousness, that the man and the woman of God might be complete for every good work. And so Scripture has the principles that God expects us to work on and apply and think about, and that's what we need to do in these areas. And I'd say a lot of the attacks on the gospel are actually attacks on things like the biblical view of the body, the Nancy Piercy book, or taking away the foundations that we talked about in Genesis 1 and the following chapters, about things like the binary nature of sexuality, human beings made in the image of God, the stewardship principle, sexuality for marriage, the sanctity of life, and so on. So, an illustration, for example, and we're not talking about infertility in great detail, we just haven't got time, but one way you can apply those principles is to think, well, what about infertility treatments? How should we think about those? And you can say, you've got to start by saying, well, there are lots of different causes of infertility and there are lots of different treatments available as well. And we know, for example, from Scripture that, and from experience, that infertility and childlessness causes a huge amount of pain and suffering. And think of Rachel, Genesis 30, verse 1. Give me children or I'll die. Do you remember she says to give me children or I'll die? Well, think about the stories of initially infertile couples through Scripture. Samson's parents and they had Samuel's, Hannah, remember, or John the Baptist. There are lots of examples of infertile couples and God's, through the display of his compassion, enabled them to have children. And so helping infertile people to have children, either through adoption or through other means, we would say, I think, resonates with the heart of God in providing children as a blessing. But we have to do God's work God's way, and the end doesn't justify the means. And so I would say that overall, the whole principle of helping childless couples meeting that need is resonates with the Christian morality. But there are boundaries we must not cross. And I'd say one of those boundaries is that we shouldn't employ technologies that destroy human embryos or treat them not as human beings. And so I have huge reservations about creating excess embryos for experimentation or freezing embryos for long periods of time, many of which will never be reimplanted, or disposing of embryos, either because we don't need them, they're surplus to ethical requirements, or because they've got some genetic abnormality. So the status of the embryo is a huge thing. But there's another principle that's important, I think, too, in infertility treatments, and that's the marriage, respect for the marriage bond itself. And you could say that donated eggs and sperm, it's not adultery in the sense that there's a physical, immoral sexual act, or that the cheating and lust elements of adultery are not there. But nonetheless, what is there is the introduction of a third person into the marriage bond, with all of the problems that that creates later on for the child in terms of identity and so on. The God's model was that we bring up our biologically related children who are the children of the two parents, and that adoption was a God-given means in a fallen world of providing support for orphans or children who did not have families. But God adopts us into his family, doesn't he, as adopted children. So there's just an illustration of how you might apply these principles when you're thinking about an ethical issue. So I encourage you to go away and think about these and then do further reading on the things that we haven't got time to deal with today. So this next, the fourth of our six modules is really talking about bioethical issues. And I want to start by saying that almost all these areas we've considered, whether it's abortion, euthanasia, embryo research, the whole transgender thing, same-sex marriage, all of these things at some level involve the exploitation of innocent human beings. There are victims involved in all of them. And that we have a duty as Christians not just to proclaim the gospel, but to be a voice for the voiceless. And all the way through the prophetic literature, we see typified here by Proverbs 31:8, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. And the whole concept of the poor in the Old Testament, that the poor are not just those who don't have enough money, but they're all those categories of people who can be easily exploited. You remember in the Old Testament, you've got the widows, the orphans, the aliens, and the poor, haven't you? Those four categories. And then there's that laws about the protection of those who are disabled and those who are elderly and so on. So, let's ask ourselves a question. Who is it that has no voice for whom we can speak up? And an obvious answer is elderly people with dementia or babies in the womb or embryos or women who are being exploited in the hookup culture by human trafficking or whatever. So those of us who have a voice have an obligation to use it for being advocates. And of course, the greatest advocate of all is Christ, isn't he? He's our advocate. He speaks on behalf of us to the Father. He said, I've got thee. These are my children. And so we're called to speak up for those. And then this other one, rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. I think it's got obvious implications in terms of ensuring that we do what we can in our countries to ensure that there are laws that protect people from being unjustly killed. So then how do we talk about these issues? Because I think we need to be able to talk about them in our churches, but also because they are great topics of conversation in which to bring a Christian worldview and talk to non-Christian friends about. And as we'll find, we're not alone in our concern about these a lot of these things. So first of all, realize it's a spiritual battle. Who is it that's promoting the destruction of innocent human life, the of sexual immorality, idolatry? It's the devil himself. He loves to see people killed and lives destroyed and people enslaved and addicted and relationships, marriages falling apart. So it's a spiritual battle. So when we stand up for biblical truth, we're engaging in that battle, and there's going to be opposition, and it will be costly for us. So we need Christ's winsomeness and character and the right words to say and the boldness to say it, to not to fall into the sin of silence. And then secondly, be biblically grounded. In other words, the position we take on things should be based upon scriptural principles, but use language people understand. So in the same way, when we go and share the gospel, we don't say, you need to be justified by faith and sanctified and washed in the blood of Christ, and so on. We put it all into language that people understand, don't we? And so in the same way, when we're talking about ethical issues, we need to use not just language that people understand, but also arguments that resonate with them. And you'll find there are some arguments that don't work with most people, like, just think about abortion. Most people don't believe that the fetus is a human being with rights. And so simply to say the Bible says you shall not kill is absolutely true, but it's not going to be an argument that convinces most people who don't share our convictions. But on the other hand, if you talk about women being forced to choose abortion because there's inadequate support for them and that they're being exploited and abused in this process and deserted, then you'll get more of a resonance and people start to think about it. Don't capitulate or remain silent. Don't be tempted to be silent. Realize there may be deep personal agendas. So if you're talking to someone who's very upset and incensed about abortion, it might be because they had a cousin or a sister who was in that situation, or about euthanasia. It might be someone who's been dealing with an adult relative who's had a lot of pain, and that's why. So people adopt positions on ethical issues often because of personal experiences they've had, which may be very deep and difficult. So when we're talking about LGBT issues, particularly transgender, then if you're talking to a person who has a strong experience of same-sex attraction or a sense of dissonance with their body, then realize there may be personal agendas. It's not just an intellectual discussion. And don't take emotion personally. It's really important when talking about these things, I think generally, not to get emotional and angry about it, but to be winsome and gentle. And one of the ways of doing that is to ask lots of questions. Just, as when we're sharing the gospel, it's not always the most appropriate thing just to, share the facts of the gospel, but to ask people questions which cause them to reflect upon things. So, for example, a set of questions I'll use on the subject of abortion is I'll work through the pregnancy and ask them what they think until we get to the point of discomfort. In other words, most people are not concerned about abortion in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy. But if you're talking about aborting a baby within a few weeks of birth, then most people feel a sense of revulsion about that. So you can kind of walk them through and then ask them why they feel more upset about this than the other and explore those reasons. Or a good question to ask about, start with in a discussion about abortion is ask them what they think about infanticide, killing a baby outside the womb. And most people think it's wrong. So then the next thing you ask them is, what do you think about abortion in the final trimester, the last 13 weeks of pregnancy? It'll make them think a little bit more. If they say, well, no, it's not really a human being, they'll say, well, what about a baby that's born early at 28 weeks and is in a neonatal unit? Is it wrong to... Now, that, again, they'll feel uncomfortable about infanticide. So you see what I'm saying? You're asking them questions to make them think. With regard to euthanasia, if they think euthanasia is acceptable, then just change the conditions. What about an elderly person who's tired of life? What about someone with mental health problems? What about a child who's got a chronic disease? You're pushing them to a point of discomfort where they're at least coming to the point where they think there are circumstances in which it's wrong, and then you can explore those circumstances. In the same way, if you're having a debate about sexuality, it's good to ask, you start by saying, well, what do you think about rape? Or everyone will say, well, rape's wrong, or incest, or paedophilia. Most people will say, and ask them, well, why is it wrong? Get them to think about that. Well, because you're exploiting a human being. Okay, but what if there's consent? What about paedophilia where there's consent, you see? So you're getting them to think. And then you can say, well, so what you're actually saying is that there are some forms of sex that are wrong. So you're just like me. You think some sex is admissible and some isn't. So let's explore the boundaries. And the reason I hold my view is because, but why? I'm trying to understand why you think, so you think sex is okay so long as both people are adults and there's consent. Is that what you're saying? And I might say, yeah, I think there's consent and they're both adults, that's fine. So would you be happy with incest then between an adult male and female, brother and a sister? That will make them think, you see. So what you're trying to do in all of these situations is to sow seeds of doubt to get them to reflect upon the worldview that they have and therefore make them more open to considering another point of view. And asking questions is a way of diffusing the tension and the emotion in it. Get to the worldview level. So we talked at the beginning about the theistic worldview and the atheistic worldview. Great question to ask is, now, if you're an atheist and you believe God doesn't exist and death is the end and that, human beings are important only because they have a high level of cognition or communication, then, do you think it's all right then to kill people who are intellectually disabled? Ask them that question. Or... another great question to ask is, why do you believe in human rights? You clearly believe in human rights. Why? What is it that makes... why is it wrong to exploit or kill, another human being? What's your basis for human rights? An atheist doesn't have any basis for human rights. Because the whole idea of human rights, which is so enshrined in our European laws, actually comes from the Judeo-Christian ethic. It comes right back to Genesis 1, 26 and 27. So, get to the world view level. Ask questions. What do you think happens after death? Do you think there's a God? How do you decide what's right and wrong? Why is it you think that human beings have significance? What gives them significance? And if they say, because human beings are higher... higher animals, they have this capacity for communication, rationality, and so on. And you say, well, so does that mean that a person with dementia is of less value than someone who hasn't? And again, ask questions. Know your facts, arguments, and sound bites. It's really important. In discussions on abortion, I used to do a lot of media on this, and I always started with the stats. Do you realize there's one abortion for every four live births in our country, that there are 43 million abortions every year? Most people have no clue. But that really makes them think and puts them on the back foot in those circumstances. Or sound bites. Often a short, pithy saying will encapsulate an argument in a way that will make people think. So, for example, I gave you the one before, the fetus, the baby in the womb, is not a potential human being. It's a human being with potential. Making them think. With euthanasia, it's possible to kill the pain without killing the patient. So little sound bites can be useful. Ask the permission to share your perspective. You know, can I tell you what I think about this and why? You know, I've listened to what you've had to say. And then appeal to co-belligerence. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, a co-belligerent is a person who does not share our faith, but has the same concerns as we do about some issue. And you can work in conjunction with them. Now, think about Paul being dragged up before the council, and there were the Pharisees and the Sadducees there, do you remember? And how he was put in this difficult situation. And he said, the reason I'm on trial is because of my belief in the resurrection from the dead. And what was the result of that? The Pharisees are fighting the Sadducees, aren't they? Because one of the groups believed in life after death and the other one didn't, you see. So he's using the fact that there are people who don't share his faith, but they do share some of his ideas in order to advance his argument. And I think that some of these battles in public policy and in conversation are more easily winnable than others. And the ones that are most easily winnable are the ones where we have secular co-belligerents. In other words, people who don't share our faith, but who share our concerns about the issue. And so I used to do a lot of advocacy on euthanasia and assisted suicide, and we worked together with the disability rights lobby. And most of them had completely different views than I did on abortion or on same-sex marriage or trans or whatever. A lot of them were activists in these areas as well, but they were totally with us on euthanasia because they could see that a change in the law would mean that disabled people would be exploited and abused. Transgender, we'll come back to this later, but there's now lots of groups of people who are concerned about the so-called gender revolution, parents of gender-conflicted children, psychologists who are dealing with people who've had gender transition and now want to change back again, doctors who think there's not enough evidence, lesbian and gay groups who are being persecuted by transgender activists. If you've heard of the term TERF, trans-exclusionary radical feminist, have you heard that term? So it's a term of abuse that male-to-female transgender people use against feminists. And so there's a strong feminist lobby now, which is very unhappy with the transgender revolution. Issues of freedom of speech. There are lots of people apart from Christians who are concerned about freedom of speech, like comedians, so they're concerned about the so-called cancel culture where people are being stopped saying things. So let's use them. Or sexual morality, this came up before as well, the whole Me Too movement. We're seeing a huge backlash now against the sexual revolution in the 1960s of women who are almost giving Christian views on marriage because they've seen the way that the sexual revolution has led to the exploitation of women. And radical feminists who are saying that marriage is actually a really good idea and a good thing for women because then they are, you know, properly protected and have a good income and have freedoms that they don't have if they're solo mothers. So a co-belligerent is a person with whom I do not agree on all sorts of vital issues, but who, for whatever reasons of their own, is on the same side in a fight for some specific issue of public justice. This is Francis Schaeffer's definition. And so the idea, the soundbite is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so, you know, Paul, the enemy of my enemy, so the Pharisees were enemies of the Sadducees, and so Pharisees were friends of Paul when it came to protecting his civil rights, you see. And these are just some of the examples, the Iraq War, Sunday trading, world poverty, freedom of speech, euthanasia, that certainly in the UK we've seen co-belligerence has been useful. And working with people that we don't agree with on our Christian faith enables us to pool resources, joint action together, strengthen numbers, and so on. And back in 2006, when the law was going to change to allow euthanasia in Britain, we could see that if it was just up to the evangelicals and Catholics, we weren't going to stop it. And we needed to form links with other people. And so what we did was we brought together groups, particularly including doctors, other health professionals, and lawyers, and disabled people together, and said, well, let's form a coalition. None of us is strong enough to win this on our own, but if we all work together and use arguments that we can all agree with, we're going to get something with it. But of course, in the process, we must not dilute and compromise. Now, I love this picture. The story behind this picture is that at Oxford University, a whole lot of students were playing pranks and drinking a bit too much and so on. And there was a policeman on a horse. And a student in Oxford told the policeman that his horse was gay. And the policeman arrested the student for homophobia and locked him up in a police cell overnight. And there was a big reaction to this. So, of course, Christians were concerned about it, but also one of the guys who was most concerned about it all was this chap here in the policeman's uniform. His name's Peter Tatchell, and he's one of the leading gay rights activists in the UK. But he could see that locking this guy up for saying the horse was gay was a violation of free speech, and that if these trends continued, then it would affect many other people than just, people who didn't like gay people. And so the Christian Institute, which is a public policy unit, and Peter Tatchell got together and they said, well, let's work together. And there was a particular law that was going to change that was going to limit free speech. They said, let's work together to stop it. And so they dressed up. This young man was a Christian from Christian Institute, Peter Tatchell, gay rights presenter. And he said, do you know your horse is gay? That's insulting, you're nicked. In other words, you're under arrest for that. And this picture was taken outside Parliament, where they went down when this law was being debated, and they were there together. And in the middle is a pantomime horse with two Christians in it. So it's a good example of Christians working together with those. You know, Peter Tatchell wouldn't agree with their views on most things. And you see the title is Feel Free to Insult Me. And other groups that came in were some of the comedians. So you might know Rowan Atkinson, very famous. Mr. Bean, have you ever seen Mr. Bean? Been in a lot of films. And Rowan Atkinson joined in as well, because he said, if we're not allowed freedom of speech, we're not allowed to insult people, then we comedians don't have a job anymore, you see. So, and then there are other battles which are least easily winnable, and they tend to be those where we've got no secular co-belligerents. So we haven't got people who are not Christians who share our concerns. And particularly, I think, abortion, artificial reproduction, same-sex marriage, these are much more difficult battles to ever push. You know, this is a massive change in the culture. We're not going to win on these in the short term. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it means we need to be realistic. And as we were just discussing over tea, that these, however, particularly abortion, is an area where evangelicals can work together with Catholics very effectively on it. And that's worth doing. So the message is, just because you profoundly disagree with someone on something, it doesn't mean you can't work together with them for a common cause, and that we should be doing that in areas of important areas of public policy.